In 1994, entrepreneur Peter Diamandis pledged a $10 million prize for the first privately funded team to build and fly a manned rocket into space. But he faced two problems. He wasn't sure if anyone would be able to do it, and he wasn't sure if he would be able to raise the money that he had promised. Award-winning journalist Julian Guthrie has written a book about the private race to space and about Mr. Diamandis' dream of creating a private space industry. Her book is called How to Make a Spaceship, a Band of Renegades, an Epic Race, and the Birth of Private Spaceflight. It's published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Peter Diamandis and Julian Guthrie to our show today. Hello.
A pleasure to be here.
Hi.
Julian, wasn't the American space program in the 1960s successful because it had unlimited government funding and unlimited public support?
It was, but there was also a race, and I think that that's a theme that runs throughout here in this book, and the power of competition.
But the race then had to do with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, the fact that the Soviet Union had launched the Sputnik in 1957. Do you think that we would have been involved in space exploration for any other reason?
No, I think that there was the race, and then there was the technological quest, which was put out there. There was the imperative by President Kennedy to get to the moon and back by the time the decade was out. So there were all of those factors combined.
And then Americans cheered when some Americans landed and walked on the moon. It gave our country a real sense of prestige and national pride. And then interest waned.
Well, it's a great starting point. It was in one way an ending point, but in one way it was a starting point, and it certainly was for Peter Diamandis. He was 8 years old in 1969, July, when Apollo 11 landed on the moon, and he was captivated, and so he sets out on this quest to get to space from that moment.
Well, the Apollo 11 project cost $25 billion, which was a lot more money in the 1960s. Did we cut back funding after that to pay for the war in Vietnam and social
programs? So let's jump into this. The race in 1961 was a result of a Cold War, right? So the situation is 1957, Sputnik gets launched by the Soviets. It beats the U.S. to the first satellite in space. Then
and people see it even in military terms.
Well, it is military. This is all
driven
by
military. They're going to drop bombs on us from space.
This is all being driven by the industrial military complex. My friends say that NASA is the way you keep the aerospace companies employed during peacetime. And so Sputnik launches. All of a sudden, you're not worried about planes overflying a country because you have satellites in deep space in space overflying and imaging a country below. And then comes April 12, 1961, and Gagarin, Yuri Gagarin, the first human in space, is a Soviet, not an American. John Glenn does a suborbital flight shortly thereafter. And so we're way behind in the space race. It's all a matter of bravado and ego and national pride. And JFK says something audacious. In May of 1961, he goes, "I challenge this nation to go to the moon before the end of the decade," which was an insane thing to do. And yet what happened next was 400,000 people left their jobs, left school, and went to obscure places like Titusville, Florida, Huntsville, Alabama, and Clear Lake, Texas. And they did something that was unheard of. They built from the clean sheet of paper, ground up, the ability to actually put humanity on the moon in 8 years later.
Did all of that pretty much change in 1986 when the Challenger just blew up?
No, it changed in 1970. You see, what happened was the Apollo program was a race against the Soviets, and we won the race. And then the energy, the impetus for that waned, and our desire, our budgets fell off the cliff, and we started putting money other places. The shuttle program was a weak replacement for the vision that NASA had, because in the late 60s, 1969, 1970, the plans that NASA had was that by this time we would have 1,000 people on the moon, we would have bases on Mars, we would have had thousands of people into orbit. And there's this space task group that was chartered after the Apollo program to say, what do we do next? This amazing vision for humanity and for the United States to conquest space. And the shuttle was like the lowest possible thing that we could do, minimally keep humanity or the United States in space?
My guests are Peter Diamandis, who is the subject of a book called How to Make a Spaceship, a Band of Renegades, an epic I'm finding it hard to read the cover, I'm sorry. An Epic Race and the Birth of Private Space Flight. It's published by Penguin Press. With us also is Julian Guthrie, the author of the book. And this is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Peter, you, as Julian pointed out, were fascinated with space exploration as a child. Weren't you building rockets in your basement?
Yeah, there were two things that got me going, and Julian did a beautiful job chronicling this. It was Apollo, which was I was born in 61. Apollo was, you know, the whole Mercury, Gemini, Apollo missions were going on. And the other thing that happened 50 years ago this month was the debut of Star Trek. Star Trek debuted in September of 1966, and I became a Trekkie.
And despite the fact that that show was a bomb at the time,
it only
became a success in syndication.
It was amazing, and what a success it's been. And it was, for me, the combination of Apollo and Star Trek was like, oh my God, this is humanity's future. And so I believed that. I bought into that. Yes, I had my friend Billy Greenberg and I had huge supplies of explosives in our closets. We would have been, you know, definitely seen as terrorists today. We had potassium perchlorate, potassium nitrate, and sulfur, and magnesium, and charcoal, and all the stuff we need to make rocket powder. We made our own rockets. And a number of them blew up in inappropriate places, and Julian tells that story.
As long as it wasn't on 23rd Street.
No, this isn't. No, my friends of mine's backyards, mailboxes, pools, and things like that.
And you started a student space exploration club when you were at MIT, and also the International Space University?
Yeah, so I've started about 18 companies at this point in my life. My first was I was a undergrad at MIT, and I get to MIT, and there's no space club. I'm like, this is MIT. There's supposed to be a space club here. And so I organize a group called SED, Students for Exploration and Development of Space. 25 years later, it's going strong. I start this national organization. I'm the president of the Princeton chapter, of the MIT chapter, and Jeff Bezos, who is a fellow space enthusiast, to say the least, was president of the space SEDS chapter at Princeton. And then starts this mindset I have of giving up on NASA, that it's going to be the means by which I get myself to space. And instead, it's like, I'm going to have to do this myself.
But hadn't you wanted to be an astronaut?
I did. I wanted to since my childhood. You know, I wrote to NASA. I wrote for an application. But then I met a bunch of astronauts while I was at grad school, an undergrad at MIT. And again, Julian's book tells the story in beautiful detail. I met a number of astronauts, first among them a guy named Byron Lichtenberg, who had flown twice. And I learned the truth. And the truth is that, number one, your chance of acceptance into the astronaut corps was 1 in 1,000. 1 in 1,000 get accepted. And even if you were accepted, half the astronaut corps had never flown. They were called penguins because they had wings, but they couldn't fly. And then even if you did fly, you might fly once or twice during your career. And I'm like, no, this is not my vision of space flight. You know, if you're a scuba diver, you get to go every weekend if you want. And so I set out to figure out, how do you do it on my terms?
And then your parents wanted you to become a doctor, although there were astronauts who were doctors. Why didn't a medical career appeal to you?
So I grew up in a medical family. Both my parents were born in the Greek island of Lesbos. I had very little growing up. My dad followed my mom to the U.S. He became a very successful New York physician. I was living at the time in Mount Vernon, Westchester, and then in Great Neck, and he was in the Bronx. And I was always expected, as the son of an immigrant, I would follow my dad's footsteps. I'd become a doctor. And when I told my mom at the age of 11 I wanted to be an astronaut, she says, "That's nice, son. You're going to be a doctor." And so I ended up rationalizing that if you weren't a fighter pilot, the next best statistical degree you could have is a physician. So, okay, I'll go become a doctor, make my mom and dad happy, and follow my space career.
Now, Jillian, your previous books were about the America's Cup and the closing of a Catholic church in San Francisco. How knowledgeable were you about aeronautics before you started researching this book? You obviously were not building rockets in your basement when you were a kid.
No, but in my previous two books, there's actually a theme that ties these together, I realize now, and that is there's an underdog story for all of these books. As far as my background in this field, I started almost from the beginning when I started researching this, because this literally is rocket science. And my books are very character-driven, so there's the great human drama, but there's also a technological aspect where, you know, you're trying to do something really challenging and you need to have technological breakthroughs, certainly with the America's Cup and certainly with this private race to space. So it was a learning quest for me, and it was a lot of fun. It was just an inundation of material about NASA, aviation milestones, rocketry, rocket scientists, the different methodologies that these rocketeers were using to try to win this $10 million X Prize.
So you were the first interest was in space exploration, and then you met Peter Diamandis, or
no,
did you meet him first?
I met Peter. He was the biggest space geek, I say this fondly, that I had ever met. And then through Peter, I started meeting these others who dreamed of space in a similar path through the government, only to be disenchanted with that, and then set out on this pursuit of getting there without the government's help.
Peter, by the time you left school, as you point out, NASA was winding down manned space missions. Were all of the spaceflight technologies then funded by the United States and Soviet governments?
So, you know, in the 60s, we had the U.S. and the Soviet Union as the two major space powers. And then what happens is the requirement to be able to launch Earth observation and communication satellites becomes very important. And you see the Europeans form Arianespace and get launch capabilities. The Japanese, the Chinese come on strong. And now the Chinese are one of the fastest growing national space programs. You have space programs.
What are they sending rockets up for?
They're sending humans, the taikonauts, as they call them. In the U.S., they're astronauts. In Russia, they're cosmonauts. In China, they're taikonauts. For national pride and for communications and for Earth observation and for science, these are the drivers, right? And we have Brazil building rockets. We have Israel building rockets. We have India with a very successful rocket program. So all of a sudden, all of these nations start building capabilities. But still, on a national budget, you're not so worried about the cost. And so these systems are all rather expensive and built by government contractors. Again, not so worried about the cost.
When you founded your first company, International Microspace, was it your goal to launch satellites into orbit?
It was. I had started a few companies under my belt. I just started my International Space University, which was a huge success, still is in Strasbourg, France. And I, you know, myself and a few others said, hey, let's start a rocket company. Not so easy back in 1989.
While he was in medical school.
Yeah, I was in my fourth year
in
medical
school. And where do you get the money for something like that?
You raise it. I go to friends and family, and all of a sudden you start raising tens of millions of dollars, and people have a lot of expectations, and it's a lot of weight on your shoulders. Julian tells the story in the book on how I'm the CEO of this rocket company. At the same time, I'm the founder and managing director of this university, and I'm in medical school, and I bought one of the first Motorola brick phones I had in my medical school closet, and I would sneak out of surgery to go and call and find out how the rocket firings were doing. It was an insane time.
Until he was found out by the dean and others.
But also inspired by a much lower tech incident, you read Charles Lindbergh's The Spirit of St. Louis.
Yeah. So my rocket company, ultimately, we won a large contract. We sold the company, but it didn't succeed. And I was like, you know, I really felt like we needed to make a difference. We needed to get the price down. And it wasn't about launching satellites that was really inspiring me. It was about launching people. And so the year is 1993. It's December. A dear friend of mine, Greg Marinac, who was trying to inspire me to finish my pilot's license, gives me a copy of Lindbergh's book called The Spirit of St. Louis. It won the Pulitzer Prize, I think, in 1954, thereabouts. And it's the book that chronicles Lindbergh's journey New York to Paris.
But there was also a prize involved.
And
that's what got you thinking about a prize.
Yeah, so I'm reading this book. I didn't realize Lindbergh crossed Atlantic to win a prize. I thought he woke up one day, decided to just do it. But a $25,000 prize offered by a New York hotelier, Raymond Ortega, who had started as a busboy, worked his way up to own the Hotel Lafayette, which unfortunately isn't here anymore, had been catering to World War I pilots in the late 19-teens. And so in 1919, he offers up an audacious prize of $25,000 for the first person who can fly New York to Paris. And it was thought crazy. No one could possibly do this. And it turns out that nine teams end up spending $400,000 to try and win this $25,000 prize. And I'm reading this and making notes in the margins of the book. I'm going, this is it. I'm going to start a prize that's going to inspire teams to build spaceships, take me and my friends into space.
And we will pick up the story from there after we take a little break. My guests are Peter Diamandis and Julian Guthrie. We've been talking about a book about Peter's experiences and other people involved in trying to create a private space industry. The book is called How to Make a Spaceship, A Band of Renegades, An Epic Race, and the Birth of Private Space Flight. It is published by Penguin Press. We are back, with Julian Guthrie, author of How to Make a Spaceship, A Band of Renegades, An Epic Race, and The Birth of Private Spaceflight. It's published by Penguin Press, and with Peter Diamandis, who is at the center of this story. So we talked about establishing a prize for sending for Charles Lindbergh going across the Atlantic on a solo flight. What were the rules for the competition that you were setting up, Peter?
So I wanted my prize to inspire a generation of private spaceships that could carry me and my friends into space. And I actually made notes in the book in the spirit of St. Louis, and I wrote X prize in the margin because I had no idea who's going to put up the money, who's going to be my Nobel, my Pulitzer. And I used X as the sort of placeholder. And the rules were it was going to be a $10 million cash purse. $10 million was enough in my mind to inspire the entrepreneurs, but not the Boeings and the Lockheeds. I wanted it being done in a fresh, new way.
What would that be in today's money?
Not different from that. I mean, it was 1996, so 20 years ago, probably $15 million thereabouts.
And you had a ground rule involving the Kármán line?
And the rest of the rules were as follows. So it was $10 million. You had to build a private spaceship to be privately funded. You had to carry three adults, a pilot and two paid passengers, or an autopilot and three brave passengers. It had to fly to 100 kilometers altitude, 328,000 feet, which was, by most people's definition, space, 62 miles, 100 kilometers altitude. And you had to land. And then within 2 weeks, you had to do the trip again. And that was important. It had to be a reusable spaceship. Because at the end of this competition, I wanted it to go into business to take people on a recurring flight, including me and my friends.
Although scientists and nerds are always interested in space travel, do you believe that you needed a level of danger and drama to capture the interest of the general public?
I do. We have evolved as a species where we pay tenfold more attention to negative news than positive news. And for that reason, if you watch the Crisis News Network or the Constantly Negative News Network, whatever you call CNN these days, it's 10-to-1 negative news to positive news, or open up the paper. And so people are attracted to a train wreck or a crash. And so the threat of danger definitely attracted a lot of attention.
Didn't attract funding, though, because Peter got about 150 no's as he was trying to raise the money for this $10 million prize, which he had already announced. And he had two questions asked repeatedly. Why isn't NASA doing this, and what if someone dies? So he wasn't getting the funding because of the risk.
Yeah, I had everybody turning me down. I thought it was going to be a no-brainer. All right, so in May of 1996, I announced the $10 million prize under the arch in St. Louis, but not having the $10 million. And I figured, someone's going to pay only after someone pulls it off. How easy is that? But as Julian said, and she chronicles my pitches over and over and over again to Fred Smith or Richard Branson twice, and they said, no, someone's going to die and it's going to hurt our brand and not going to give it to you. And that was tough.
And were there any private companies already building rockets at the time?
There were startups trying to. And the XPRIZE ended up having 26 teams from 7 countries registering this. And those startups folded in, you know, joined the competition. But most of the big players were only launching unmanned launch vehicles, very different from our goal.
You had a deadline of 2004. You imagined that this could be done by then?
Yeah, so the original deadline was actually December 17th, 2003, which is the 100th anniversary of the Wright Brothers flight. And as we got closer, we ended up extending the deadline to December 31, 2004. And the winner, Burt Rutan, who was backed by Paul Allen, actually won it just 2 months before the deadline ended.
Now, Eric Lindbergh comes into this story. Why did he decide to recreate his grandfather's famous flight?
Julian?
So Eric Lindbergh's story in this is amazing. So he's the grandson, of course, of Charles Lindbergh and Anne Morrow Lindbergh, the wonderful writer and aviatrix herself. And he starts out, you see this amazing journey with Eric Lindbergh. He starts out dubious about whether he should get involved in the XPRIZE. He's like, there are enough problems here on Earth. Why do we need $10 million prize to go to space? He becomes convinced that this view from on high will benefit humanity in really profound ways. He gets involved. And when it comes to 2002, the XPRIZE was really in dire straits financially. Eric had become committed to this cause, and he decides to recreate his grandfather's historic flight on the 75th anniversary. So he does this, and it's really...
His family didn't want him to fly.
His family didn't want him to fly. You know, the Lindberghs, I think this book tells more than any other book really what the Lindbergh legacy means to those who are living with it today, for better and for worse. So he risks these family ties, really, to make this flight. And he had, you know, been battling rheumatoid arthritis, and it's a pretty amazing feat on his part. And he rescues the XPRIZE. And in a way, he was rescued by the XPRIZE.
Was he flying an airplane similar to the Spirit of St. Louis?
No, it was a modern day.
It was a Lancair 400, which was, you know, and he had a mission control based in St. Louis. But he still got a lot of publicity. He raised $1 million for the XPRIZE Foundation at a time where we were running out of cash. And, you know, had he not risked, and it was, you know, you risk your own life. He trained for it. And Julian does a beautiful job telling that story.
And you see there are photos in the book, and you see one picture of Eric where he's just had knee surgery because of his rheumatoid arthritis, and he's barely walking, you know, and he's just hobbling. And then you see this other picture of him where he's standing, you know, on the wing of the Lancair in victory. And so it carries him through that journey in really neat ways.
What is hole-in-one insurance?
So it turns out that there is a kind of insurance policy you can buy in which the insurance company bets against you. So this is the way it works. If you ever go to a golf course and they say there's $1 million if anybody sinks a hole in one, I'm not a golfer, so this is like, you know, secondhand information. Sinks on a hole in one on the 13th hole or whatever it might be. The golf course doesn't have $1 million sitting around to pay. What they do is they go to an insurance company and they pay an annual premium, say, of $10,000. And if no one sinks a hole-in-one on the 13th green that year, the insurance company pockets the $10,000. But if someone does, the insurance company pays off. And so it's you're betting against someone doing it. So let me set the setting. It's 1999. We had just launched the $10 million prize 3 years earlier under the Arch in St. Louis. And I'm out trying to raise the money. And as Julian chronicles, my typical answer is no, this is insane. Why isn't NASA doing this? Can't, you know, I don't think anybody can do it, and someone's going to die trying. So no, you're not sponsored. So 150 no's later, I'm getting desperate. Teams are calling me saying, hey, Peter, we're building our spaceship. Do you have the money yet? And Bob Weiss, a dear friend, Hollywood producer, the producer of the Blues Brothers Naked Gun series, who had been my vice chairman of the board, says, you know, we should look at a hole-in-one insurance policy. And like, what is a hole-in-one insurance policy? And he explains it to me. And we go out through Aon Insurance and we place it. And we get an insurance policy that basically says roughly, you know, if you pay us $3 million and someone wins, we'll pay out the $10 million. If no one wins, we keep the $3 million. And that was it.
It was interesting because when Peter first heard about it, he was like, really? But then he thought, you know, I love the irony of, you know, people have been betting against this from the beginning, and now we could actually get our payout from someone betting against us.
How did Anousheh Ansari get interested in space travel? Wasn't she the first woman and the first Iranian to go into space as a tourist?
So Anousheh enters the story. She was born in Tehran, grew up like I did, we're, I think, roughly the same age, inspired by space and Star Trek, which actually was showing in Tehran back then. And she came to the U.S. in high school, became a serial entrepreneur. The year is 2000, 2001. I had just been, you know, turned down. Oh, I'm getting desperate at this point. And I open up a copy of Forbes magazine, and in it is an issue on the wealthiest 40 women under 40. I'm not married at the time. This is another alternative financing mechanism. But in her bio, she says, I dream about flying on a suborbital flight into space. And I knew in that moment she was the one who was going to fund this. And I track her down. Long story, again, beautifully chronicled in of how this happens. She's vacationing in Hawaii for 2 months. I'm her first meeting when she gets back. And after, you know, a few conversations, the Ansari family basically says yes, they're going to fund the prize. And ultimately, they actually funded the hole-in-one insurance policy and our operations. And we name it the Ansari X Prize in their honor.
This whole story is kind of international. You have an engineering student in Bucharest, Dumitru Popescu, who plays a role in this whole story.
He's a fantastic story, actually. So he drops out. He hears about the X Prize. He's in an internet cafe, and he's looking up the latest in missiles, and he sees something about the X Prize, and he sees that it appears that Bert Rattan has entered the race. And he's like, he calls his wife, you have to come to the internet cafe right away, right away. And she comes down, and he tells her in that moment, I am dropping out of school, and we're going to go after this prize. And she, of course, looks at him, you know, rather puzzled. They go for it. He ends up, you know, building rockets in his father-in-law's backyard in Bucharest, just outside of Bucharest. And now, you know, he's got an aerospace company in New Mexico, but it's really an amazing story. He was digging ditches and, they were working out in the hot sun in the father-in-law's backyard. And he had great success, actually launched the largest private rocket ever flown from Romania.
Well, Bert Rattan is an aviation designer who became the winner of the X Prize, but he built the first plane that circled the world in 1986 without stopping or refueling. So you did have a winner here. He followed all the rules. He was able to do all the things that you had required.
Yeah, Bert did a beautiful job. He met all the rules, and when he debuted his airplane, his spaceship, I should say, in 2003, before it flew, he paid me the biggest compliment that anyone did. He said, Peter, this competition, the rules you wrote 8 years ago are as valid today as they ever were. And you know, the XPRIZE has gone way beyond just flying private spaceships. We now run competitions in extracting CO2 from smokestacks and reinventing healthcare and reinventing education and all of these things. We've launched $120 million worth of prizes. We have another $100 million of prizes under development. And the rules are the DNA, critically important.
But when you ask people who haven't read this book to talk about private space flight, the names that always come up are Elon Musk and Jeffrey Bezos.
Yep.
Are they the prime players these days?
They are the two players who have committed the most of their private wealth. And it's interesting. I've known Jeff. In fact, Jeff and Elon both play a cameo role in the book. I knew Jeff when he was at Princeton. I was at MIT. I had started this SEDS organization, and Jeff was the chapter president of Princeton. I met Elon in 2000 when he was just sold PayPal and was trying to figure out, what do I do next? and we were meeting about his space interests. And both of them have committed their fortune to opening up space. I was with Jeff Bezos just this past week. He won the Heinlein Prize, which I won 10 years ago, and Elon won 5 years ago, and Jeff just won this year. And Jeff wants to get millions of people into space and heavy industry into space during our lifetime. Elon wants to get humans to Mars in the next decade, personally, privately. And so that gives me great hope that we're going to really have an exciting time in the future.
Although we still have the rockets blowing up, not necessarily succeeding. So isn't it still a little dangerous today?
Of course it's dangerous, but this is no different than airplane flight in the 1920s. You know, it was something that was possible. People were buying tickets, and it eventually, only by the large volume, did it become safe. And we can think of it today as a no-brainer.
My guests have been Peter Diamandis, who is at the heart of a book called To Make a Spaceship, A Band of Renegades, an Epic Race, and The Birth of Private Spaceflight, published by Penguin Press. Also, Julian Guthrie, who wrote the book. It's been my great pleasure to have both of you on our show.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, How to Make a Spaceship is a great book, and I hope people will be inspired by it. Get it for your kids, your friends. Thank you.